Hello and welcome to the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm Keith Burgun. Today we have a really exciting interview that's one that I've been wanting to have like since the beginning of the show. I'm sad that we didn't have it sooner. I'm excited to do it again. This is Naomi Clark, and she teaches at the NYU Game Center, which we've had a few other guests from there. She's just like a really one of the smartest people I've ever talked to. Very inspirational to me in a lot of ways. She's a writer. She's fantastic on Twitter. You have to follow her. She's at MetaCynthy. She just did a successful Kickstarter for Consenticle, which is just awesome. Check it out. Look up the art, look up the game. It's really great. Unfortunately, it turns out it's going to be kind of hard to get a hold of a copy, unless you play the print and play version, which you'll find out some information about that at the end of the podcast. But, she's really great. She's written book, at least one book on game design with Anna Anthropy, which I thought was probably the best game design book of that kind that I've ever read. And so she's just great. And I'm really excited to be able to present this interview to you. We talked about a lot of stuff. We talked about basically the problem started off with how do we responsibly design systems? And because she did a GDC talk about that, I also did a talk that was sort of about that. Apparently Frank Lance also did a talk about that, which I have yet to watch, which I feel really bad about. I will check that out soon. We talked about all kinds of stuff, meta rationality, off ramps, providing off ramps for players. We talked about addiction. We talked about, my general project of game design and deeper strategy game designs, and how does that fit into this sort of ecosystem as Naomi sees it. And so I found it to be really a great conversation, and I'm really happy with it. Before I get into the conversation, real quick, just want to give you a couple of updates. This summer is going to be really big in terms of my games and prototypes, I think, because they've got three things. I've got two things, and Dino Farm Games has one thing that all are like on the cusp of being able to be something I can show people. So I'm really excited for that. Please stay tuned for that. I have two new articles that I've been working on and off. Those should be coming soon. I've got at least one more podcast interview and one podcast without an interview planned. Just a bunch of stuff in the works. And all this stuff happens because... Oh, and I also stream a lot on Twitch. Twitch.tv/Keith Burgun. Come by. I play games. We're doing a game design book club over at my forums and my Discord right now, which you can all access from keithburgun.net. Come be a part of the book club if you want. We vote on new games every month, and then we play them, and we... argue about them, and we talk about the game design merits of them, and it so far has been pretty cool. This month is a game called Gwent, which you may have heard of. It's a collectible card game set in the Witcher universe, and we're also playing Solar Settlers by Brain Good Games, who, if you haven't checked them out, you should check them out too. And all of this stuff is possible because other people are doing out there. So if you think it's worth supporting, it really means a lot to me. And thank you very much. And now, without any further ado, let's check out this Naomi Clark interview. First, let's talk about Consenticle really quickly, because I do think that's one of the, that's kind of like a good starting point for a discussion about this topic, I think. And also, it's just a notable kind of it's a really notable game, I think, that's worth people should know about it. I'd like my audience to have heard your pitch about Consenticle, what it is and why people should care.
Sure. So I'm flattered that you feel like it's notable. That means a lot to me coming from you. Consenticle is a game that I've been working on for the last 4 years on and off, although I did the first version back in 2014, I think it was. And it sort of sat dormant for a long time. People kept asking me how they could get a copy of it. So last fall, I put together a Kickstarter to actually fund the production of the game. And that finished successfully. And I just heard this morning, actually, that there are 7,000 copies that have been loaded onto ships and are making their ways to different ports around the world, where they're going to be shipped out to backers. And I should probably describe what the game is. It's a two-player cooperative card game that is about a relationship between a human being and an alien. And so that's, you can kind of tell from the title that it is about tentacle sex, because the alien has tentacles. Mm-hmm. And and it's an intimate relationship. And the basic premise is, if you were to encounter a being who is very different than you, and you might not be able to communicate in the ways that you're normally used to, could you negotiate a mutually satisfying consensual relationship? So it's a game that has a lot of communication and some vulnerability and challenges therein. It's also sort of a lighthearted game, and it's, although the theme is sexual, it's not NC-17 or X-rated. Mm-hmm. It was designed to be played in public by strangers, and that's mostly how it's been played so far. So it's intended to be an approachable game about sex that you could play with someone, whether they're a friend or you're flirting with them, or they're someone that you just met at a con, mm-hmm. Or they're your partner. And you can sort of explore like a coordination problem, right? That's the sort of drier way to look at it. Like, how do we figure out how to cooperate, even though we don't know exactly where each other are at, right, or like what affordances are available to us, and there are limits on our communication, like our visibility to each other, and we have to figure out how to kind of operate this system together.
Yeah, and I've not played Consenticle yet, because, you know, I haven't had a physical copy of it, but I did read the rules. You sent me the rules a few years ago, and I thought it was really interesting looking, and I'm really excited to get my copy. One of the copies on that shipment is coming to me, which I'm super pumped about. So I do think it's a good example of maybe some of, like, it just seems like a socially aware game, and that's one thing that I really I like a lot, and that I think that I want to talk about a lot with you, because we both gave really similar talks. You gave a micro talk at GDC last year.
Yep.
And mm-hmm.
This year, just a couple of months ago.
Oh, that was a couple. Yeah, right. Okay, yeah. And I was really interested in that. Because I'm always interested in the stuff you're doing, but also because it was a lot like, it had a lot of overlap with a talk I gave last Indiecade, and I think you mentioned that Frank Lance had also done a talk that was similar at GDC. I haven't watched that one yet. But give me the rundown about your talk. I wrote a bunch of notes about your talk. I listened to it twice. I liked it a lot. But yeah, give me the overall take of your GDC micro talk.
Yeah, so my micro talk was called Failures of Systems Thinking, Pitfalls of Systems Thinking, since I don't think they're necessarily failures. And it was kind of taking this idea that, well, games are particularly good at this one thing, at being able to think with systems, whether you're doing that in order to have an experience for entertainment or to learn something, like, you know, a game is being used in schools. And I think it was James Paul Gee, who was one of the pioneers in this idea that, oh, games are actually really good tools for educating people, because they're not just didactic, like reading out of a textbook, right? Mm-hmm. You can sort of experience how something works from inside of it. And that doesn't just teach you how that thing works. It also gives you this skill called systems thinking, which is often cited as a type of 21st century literacy that we all need to get better at. And I had been thinking a lot last year and at the beginning of this year about how that term gets deployed as part of the overall PR for how great games are. I've used it a lot myself in the past, too, when sort of pitching games or talking about how games could be useful in different contexts. And I had been kind of collecting a number of examples and ideas of, like, well, can't this go wrong sometimes? Because if it's such an interesting, complex, valuable thing, then surely we should be paying attention to, like, the gaps in how well that works, or like what could happen when it goes haywire. So it was kind of a rundown of different pitfalls that I saw, that a lot of them are sort of related or overlap. They kind of point back at certain kinds of properties of games when they are used as simulations, or when they're abstractions of something, or and how games are bounded and what sorts of decisions you make in them and what the ultimate goals are when you're playing, like a lot of conventional assumptions that I think show up as particularly interesting pitfalls when you're trying to use games to do something more than, oh, just have an escapist good time, which is something I'm always interested in, even though almost all of the games that I've made over in my career have been primarily for entertainment. There's always more than just entertainment going on. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not somebody who sort of believes in this, like, pure escapism. There's no connection between the rest of my life and the game. It's like exists in a bubble and then, like, just vanishes.
It's just a joke.
I press quit. Yeah. Right. It's all, it's not real. Like, why would you care about anything that's in the game, right? This doesn't matter as long as it's pushing my pleasure sensors. So I've always found that point of view laughable. So I think this stuff is worth thinking about no matter what kind of game you're trying to make. And then at the end of this talk, Jesper Juul, the sort of noted game theorist and author, you know, like classic ludologist, he came up to me and was like, oh, I really enjoyed your talk. I think it was really a defense of systems thinking, which of course is one, like, something I would expect Jesper to say, because he's like very much a formalist. And he's not entirely wrong, right? I'm not saying like you should throw systems thinking out the window completely. What I'm really saying in this talk is you ought to be like way more careful about this, because it's not really totally simple. And if you just proceed on like centuries or decades worth of assumptions about like, oh, how do you make a game? And then you're like, plus it does all this new stuff.
It's
system thinking. You could like quickly like just fall like right into a trap without even realizing it, or like do something that's the opposite of what your intention is, because we haven't really explored what the downsides of this are at all.
Right. Now, so there's kind of, it's like a double-edged sword sort of thing with systems and how they can affect people in these profound ways. And there was this, actually, before we get into the specifics of your talk, let's talk quickly about like just like sort of the timeline, because I think a lot of this started happening in the last, 5, 10, 15 years and I'm wondering if, do you think it was that we first started noticing the positive ways in which games and systems could be used to teach people things that we want them to know about and we want them to do, and maybe like gamification even falls into that category a little bit, and then using that, like, that knowledge, did we start realizing, oh, well, actually, maybe we should also care then about the toxic bad stuff that we're putting into games? Or was it the other way around? Like, was it that we, my understanding of the timeline is that, we started thinking like, oh, wow, we can really like change the way people think using games. And that has all this potential. And then I feel like out of that came a little bit more social consciousness about, a feeling of social awareness, which sort of led to some like degree of like feminist critique of games and other kinds of critique. Does that sound correct to you?
Kind of. I actually think it's a ping pong back and forth between those poles that has been going on for centuries.
Okay.
And that's what's really fascinating to me about it. You can go back quite a long ways to find like all sorts of unsavory reputation for games, right? That like games are seen as a low degenerate activity that's enjoyed by the like ruder elements of society, workers and soldiers and gamblers and lowlifes who aren't contributing to society. And then they're like in the 19th century, there's an effort to rehabilitate games out of that and say, oh, actually, no, games can be used for really positive purposes.
Right.
And that's actually where we get commercial board games as a product from that movement, right? So that we wouldn't really have the idea of like, oh, designers make new board games and sell them if that hadn't actually been attempted. And it was attempted by folks who made games like The Mansion of Happiness in England, and then Milton Bradley with The Game of Life. That was like very much, it was like, okay, I'm going to make this game where it's going to be used as a tool for moral edification. Hmm. We're going to sort of teach, and families can play it together now that it's the Industrial Revolution and people have electricity or gaslight even at night. And then they can, sit around and play with each other as something to do besides just reading the Bible. Sure. And Yeah, that's an idea that he got from India, where actually it had been a practice for much longer with Gyan Chapur or Snakes and Ladders. Right? So he sort of adapted Snakes and Ladders into the game of life. And but he couldn't put dice in the box because it was associated with gambling. So he had to put a spinner. He had to, you know, adapt a dreidel into a spinner.
Yeah, and even Monopoly was sort of a game for change, wasn't it? The original, yeah. The landlord's game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a similar day. It was like, oh, I don't want to teach people Christian values. This was the original designer of the landlord's game, Elizabeth Magee, and she was much more interested in critiquing the dominance of landlords over property and how that sort of kept people in poverty. And so that was really the genesis of Monopoly, right? So there was that whole movement happened long before the digital age. And then, you know, I think we sort of saw a recapitulation of that in some ways, where games rose up, like initially digital games as a form of entertainment, but also a form of research for computing technology, right? That was kind of the positive purpose in the early days of video games. Mm-hmm. And then they spread like wildfire because they were very like attractive as entertainment sources, initially for families as a sort of like, oh, positive, edifying thing. And that's why there were an early parallel in the number of games for entertainment were paralleled by a lot of educational games back in those days, so, which were, I think, generally of much lower quality and a lot more clones. But if you look at just the numbers, it was really pitched to families. And that
the
turned out to be...
The family computer, right? Exactly. Nintendo family computer, yeah.
Right, and so up until like the mid-80s, that's where you would see on all the advertisements where it's like, you know, families playing together, right? Because it was following that board game model. And then it turned out like that was really difficult to do with computers in a number of ways, in part, I think, because of the single-player leanings of digital technology. And so then the companies that were part of this growing industry just shifted all their attention to trying to sell games to like adolescent boys. And then those are the only people that you saw in the ads starting in the mid-80s. It was all like, the boys are playing games. And then maybe a girl runs up and is like, can I watch what you're doing? You know,
right.
And the ads totally changed. And then the sort of next wave of like, oh, maybe this is a bad influence on the young men, right? Which echoes the same thing of like, oh, our young men are just whittling away their inheritances and going to these gambling halls and gambling with sailors and soldiers, right? It's like... a sort of degenerate bad influence, except this time it was like, well, you know, with tabletop games, it was, oh, you're going to become a Satanist. And with a video game, it's like, oh, you're going to, you know, become unable to distinguish fantasy from reality. And then once Columbine happens, of course, the effects of violence really start to go front and center with all of this. And I think it's, again, there's a move to try and rehabilitate video games out of their image as just being frivolous distractions for young kids or being horrible, pernicious influences like sucking up the free time and the, you know, sending bad messages to young boys and men. And I think that's where you get folks like, say, like James Paul Gee saying, actually, we could use these in schools if we really think about how to teach with games instead of just trying to shovel educational topics into like Math Blaster or something.
Right.
And and you get Jane McGonigal saying, oh, it's even wider than that. Games can have like extraordinary positive effects on people's like motivation, and we can sort of harness all the energy that's going into games and use it to do good things in the real world and so forth.
So I'm particularly interested in the negative side of this conversation, meaning like the destructive side of games and what they can do negatively. And there, I have a specific reason for that, and that's that I'm particularly interested in making those, I wouldn't say escapist, but like, you know, sitting and focusing on a particular system, learning a system, you know my spiel.
Right.
That's the kinds of things that I love to make. So I'm not particularly interested in making educational games or necessarily even games for change, although I support those kinds of games.
Sure.
And so, but for me, my challenge, and I think the challenge of people who are making games like myself, is how can we do what we want to do without, at least without causing damage and causing trouble? And I tend to think that the default, like the standard issue, like, you know, modus operandi of making games these days is, you know, laden with all kinds of problems. And I think you talked about a lot of those in your GDC talk, just a few of them. There's so many of them. A lot of them are very well known to people. I liked yours because you you were getting more abstract with yours.
Yeah.
Things like confusing the map and the territory you talked about. This spotlight on this one crucial decision. I think it's interesting because like a lot of the things that you complain about from a, I think a social perspective, I would also complain about from a completely abstract game design formalist, perspective for other reasons. But my point is that I often find that the thing that's socially good is also happens to be good for the system itself too, in other ways. And there's interesting reasons for why that is. And there's also a couple of times where that's not the case. And so I'd like to talk about that too. I'm trying to think of the best way to frame the conversation because there's so much to talk about here. What do you think is, like, how can we make, so you know the kinds of games I want to make. I want to make, my talk at IndieCade was called Single Player Strategy Games That You Can Live In. Single Player Competition, Strategy Games That You Can Live In. That was what it was called. I think you were there, if I'm not mistaken, or something. You were definitely at IndieCade.
Yeah.
But, the talk was about how I want to make these big systems. I don't want to make these like cute little, you know, tiny tactical games. I want to make these big things that you can live in, meaning you can play them over and over for years and years. They can be a part of your life the way that like a chess player has chess as part of their life, or a tennis player has a tennis as part of their life, or a guitar player has guitar playing as part of their life. I want to make games as disciplines and as things that you can live in. And there's two ways in which you can live in the game. One is that it's deep and it's big, and that means it's complicated and there's a lot to explore. And two is that it's like not this hostile, toxic environment that just, you know, kind of like makes you feel bad or makes you into like a subtly worse person in some way. But it's a place that you kind of on some level are okay living in. That's kind of my big mission. And on that first point about I'm sort of pitching you my talk here.
Yeah.
The one area where the systems concern and the social concern I feel like sort of don't align exactly is that in order to make a very complicated system, a very deep strategy game, it seems like you have to lean on, in a practical sense, you have to lean on what players already know somewhat. You know, so you have to, like, it's hard to sell someone, and I don't mean sell necessarily commercially, although that's part of it, but it's hard to, like, it's hard to give someone a game that's big, complicated, and completely, like, new, and doesn't, like, lean on mechanical tropes that people already understand. And so the big point of my talk was, we might have to lean on some of these like things that I consider to be a problem socially or even systemically sometimes, because there's so much that we have to communicate with one of these big strategy games. So that's my thing, but I'm also struggling with that myself. Like, I'm not really sure if there are ways to avoid that. Am I making sense? Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I definitely do. So you're saying like, well, everyone sort of, I think of the classic problem here as being the combat system, right? There are certain models of game where it's just very, very easy to put in a combat system because everyone sort of already understands how it works. It's a very like easy economy to model and design.
Right.
And so it's like incredibly difficult to say make a roguelike and then just be like, let's do something else completely different that's not a combat system or that doesn't bear mechanical resemblance to a combat system, which, you know, you could make a combat system and then like retheme it so that it's all about like, oh, you got all my gummy bears or something. But it's hard to move away from that completely.
Right. Once you retheme it, you start losing some of that sort of free information thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. And even then, it's like you still have this mechanical underpinnings of like, I want to reduce your number to zero before you reduce my number to zero. And that's like...
Right. And when you get away from that, then it gets really hard to learn.
Really? Oh,
like,
yeah. Not only hard to learn, but very hard to design with certain kinds of games, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, anything with like an RPG backbone, and I guess roguelikes kind of fall into that category, like really leans very heavily on that. Yeah, so I know what you're talking about. And I guess I have two thoughts, and you can pick. Like, I can tell you, I think the good news about social change in your project, or like what I think is the bad news about your project.
I want to hear them both, particularly the bad.
Okay, which one do you want first then?
Let's do the bad first, I guess.
All right. So part of what's come up in this discussion, and actually this was even more so in Frank's talk than mine, is that just trying to create one game that you live in and have this sort of be the complete experience, that like that actually may be in some ways the biggest problem. Because one of the advantages of games that kind of breaks down some of the problems with the hyper rationality and kind of limited focus of games is that you can kind of like move between systems and be like, oh, well, what applied in this game doesn't apply in that game. And like this game is emphasizing something completely different. I have to toss like the ideas and things that like my brain was getting completely used to, the mold it was settling into from the other game, I have to toss it out the window. And that actually promotes what Frank was discussing as a type of fluid meta-rationality, where you don't accept the dictates of one system as being like all that you have to focus on and like everything that takes over your brain. Instead, you're like, oh, I actually need to like pick up and drop systems, not accept any of them as truth, not like take them in this complete, like totally literal minded way. You know, even when you're just immersed in it for entertainment, it's still like, you know, if you're cognitively immersed, it's like sort of taking over all your thought processes, right? It's like working out certain muscles and not other muscles in your mind. So trying to like focus on one game or even, you know, like one person's work or trying to like evaluate all games by the same like overarching standard is a little bit of a problem, because what Frank was saying we ought to be looking for in this age where we need to kind of move beyond just valorizing rationality alone and try to like advance to meta-rationality is that, yeah, that we should be like trying out different things and like hopping between stuff, and that we can't, that the danger in games is that they could become totalizing systems.
So I totally agree with that. That's a really good point. However, I think that, so like, if we take the games that we have now, and I guess I'm trying to think, like, what's an example of a game, I guess you might say like a League of Legends or something is one of these games that people live in that would also meet my criteria as like a strategy game. And would you say that like qualifies as one of these like all encompassing, like your only game kind of games? Because my concern is that this idea that just because something is a game that you can live in, that you're going to just not ever play any other games. I mean, I think that's a valid concern, but I also just wonder if that's like on a practical level, something that we need to worry about. Like it almost sounds like, well, watch out. We don't want to make our games too deep, you know, or too good. Whereas like I'm saying, like our games are really not very good and we really need to make them much better, much deeper. And, you know, we don't have like what I'm saying is like, we're not in danger of making games that are so great that people are only going to play one game.
I don't think it's a question of them being so great. People don't play only one game because it's so great. That would be a mistake to think that, right? The mistake is the danger is that a game is too absorbing, and that does not equate to a game being good. If it's really like I can just pour all of my time into a single game and like not really have to think with others, systems, it doesn't matter whether, you know, a game could be bad. Like chess is kind of a bad game, right? And that's like the chess is what like Nabokov said about like if you want to ruin a young person's life, teach them how to play chess, right? And then because you'll sort of become absorbed in it, you'll spend all your time doing that. Now, that was back in the days when the biggest concern was you're going to spend all your time and money doing this activity. And then the concern became, oh, you're going to like lose your sense of reality and think that like you're not be able to understand the real world and that the game world are two different things. Now, I think those are sort of more simplistic concerns from earlier times. And what I'm concerned about now is like, oh, that you will be kind of working your mind out in a way where you're only like flexing certain types of muscles. You're thinking along certain lines. Yeah. And so it's like going to the gym, right? Like we know like, okay, exercise is good for you, but we know that there are ways that you could do a workout, which would be bad for your body, right? Never thinking about this in terms of like how we're working out our minds. So like, yeah, like you could go to the gym and just do reps with your, you know, your left bicep, like over and over again. And then you would you get like a super weird, distorted looking body, even though you'd have like a really strong bicep. And maybe that would be bad. Maybe you'd like try to open a door and you'd rip it off its hinge unless you open it with your right hand. Right. So it's a little bit silly sounding when you apply it to muscles because they're sort of limited. But I think there's like a subtle effect and it's more difficult to deal with and maybe more pernicious because it's subtle, where if you just get very used to thinking in one way, then that is going to have some ripple effects in the rest of your life. And we know that it's true that like that games take up certain neuronal pathways even after you stop playing them. This is why you can see Tetris shapes falling when you close your eyes, right? Or like, you know, why you like go outside and you like after playing Grand Theft Auto and you're like, I could just open that door and get in that car, right? It's not because not because you're deluded and you think, now I'm a criminal and I can carjack people and it'll be fine.
Right, of course.
Right? That's the old silly idea. But this sort of persistence of like ways of thinking about things and like ways of operationalizing the world, that I think is tricky. And the more obvious things like Tetris blocks or like Grand Theft Auto carjacking and like noticing patterns in the world, which is really what that is. Those are sort of easy to notice and then fade. But I think there are subtler things that because we don't have access to much of how our consciousness works, right? It's like mostly happening below our levels of perception that I think that the scary thing is that this stuff is sticking around in some ways that's changing us, and that maybe it's all fine, maybe it kind of washes out after a while, but if you were to just play one game like with all of your free time for the entirety of your life, like I have no doubt, at least, I mean, tell me if you disagree, it's like it's going to change the way that your brain operates because you're reflecting certain things, right?
Yeah. No, so I feel like I have to bring up this thing that maybe feels like it's not necessary to bring up, but I do feel like it's a major component of what's going on here, and which is the whole like addictive games and like, you know, the whole Skinner boxy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Because when you're talking about like, you know, a game that just completely like what was the word you used? It was
totalizing.
There was another word you used where someone absorbing.
Yeah, absorbing, right, which is not necessarily good, right? Like,
right, so what I want to do is I want to make a game that's like the piano or that's like the guitar or something, like, that is not compelling to play it in the way that most modern video games are, because pretty much every video game, and that this is what I think distorts this conversation sometimes a little bit, is that, you know, when we're living in this world where like these addictive, you know, gambling kind of mechanisms are being employed just all the time in games. And I feel, and maybe you disagree with this, but I feel like that's not games don't have to be that way. And I do know of games like board games, for example, that at least if they are using those mechanisms, it's to a far less degree. I guess you might argue all games use them in some way. I could accept that, but I think that there's a matter of degree there too. And I think that, you know, like, for example, I was just playing this game, Gwent. It's a collectible card game that's set in the Witcher universe. Talk about social issues with that game, but, it has some extremely, like, you know, it's a CCG. So like you've got the loot boxes or whatever, the booster packs constantly. And I found myself, as someone who's super skeptical of CCGs, I hate their gameplay. I don't think their gameplay is good at all. And I found myself getting addicted to it because it's just like, we know how to like press those buttons in people now. And so, you know, when I talk about making games that people can live in, I don't want to addict people, to compel them, to absorb them even. But I want there to make games that will be there for you if you want them. And the games that I feel we have now are games that you kind of get it after a couple weeks of playing the games. And so, and then after that, it's like, you know, the only thing that's going to keep you going there is that like, that collection, you know, thing, freshen the meta and all these like new content, we need new flashy things in order to keep us there. And so, you know, I don't know if I'm doing a good job.
Well, let me ask you a question.
I'm trying to draw a distinction between.
Yeah, so sure. Let's set aside first, like, the monetary exploitation issue, because I think that's, like, well understood. It's, like, that's pretty bad. Like, you could make money off of, like, addicting people to stuff. Gwent is an interesting example because, as far as I know, at least in some versions of The Witcher, it's not like you're paying extra for these loot boxes, right? It's, like, part of the game.
Well, I haven't played the one in The Witcher. I'm playing the Gwent standalone game, and in that you definitely can buy random
booster packs. There's a games inside The Witcher. Maybe it doesn't have random booster packs, but we can certainly imagine a form of game that has these mechanics and therefore is addictive that isn't trying to monetarily exploit people for it, right? Like,
true, of course.
Candy Box was the sort of free example of the idle game that doesn't, like, you know, isn't trying to make money off of people. And there are older examples too. But so if we set that aside, what is it that makes, like, a very absorbing strategy game? Like, I know the classic example that a lot of people are familiar with would be Civilization, right? It's maybe, you know, it has its flaws as a game or as a strategy game, but you can, like, look up and you're like, oh my God, 8 hours went by, right? It has that quality. Mm-hmm. And so it is, it's like, that's also what I mean by absorbing, right? Not just, oh my gosh, I got to open the next loot box. I need to grind more to, like, get my next thing so I can try and upgrade my equipment or whatever.
Sure.
But we think of one of those things as being totally fine and one of those things as bad. And I think, you know, I kind of can see why, because what we sort of, one, we understand that the one is kind of very linked to gambling and exploiting cognitive weaknesses. And so we feel a lot more regret when we've poured a lot of time or effort into something that's sort of just messing with us in that way. And, right. But also I think that's weirdly is a hidden blessing. If you look at the overall issue of absorption being a problem that I was talking about before, because when we realize this gambling system is, like, totally busted and terrible and it's exploiting me, even if it's not for money, it's just, like, you know, exploiting my time or my cognitive weaknesses, then that's actually the what some people would call, like, the off-ramp. This is actually an idea that that I think Bennett Foddy first introduced me to a number of years ago because he studied addiction in his practice as a philosophy professor, too. And that certain types of games have this off-ramp where you're like, oh, okay, I can just stop playing now and it's okay. Civilization right. doesn't really have that until you get to the end of the game, or I don't know, until you, like, mm-hmm. something gets nuked, or you've totally polluted your planet. You're like, oh shit, I like screwed this run up. I'm going to start over, right? Like, that would be an off ramp, but right. it's much more rare. And other types of games, like, say, like a skill performance game, if you get a high score, that's often an off ramp because you're going to experience a reversion to the mean, and you're, like, not going to hit that score again for a while, right? So
yeah,
and then with, like, these, like, more exploitative games, there is this feeling that you get to where you're like, I'm addicted to this and it's not providing me value anymore. And that's really what addiction is. It's like we're all addicted to water, right? But that doesn't bother us because we're like, oh, I, you know, get something good out of water. It hydrates me and keeps me from dying and, you know, like keeps me from having a headache from being dehydrated. But addiction, when we talk about it, is like something that's no longer providing us with the value that we were seeking in it. But yet we still have this association in our neurons that like our brains think it's going to provide some sort of value and we're being tricked, right? So the upside of that is that once you realize you're being messed with, and in a game, I think this happens more quickly and more readily than with like cigarettes or heroin or anything else. Yeah. Like you can kind of see it happening. You can go on a forum for any free-to-play game and find people who are like, oh, I got to stop this. This sucks.
Of course.
That's the good thing about those games is that people are being like, oh, I have to like expel this from my system. And people quit playing those games all the time. There's in the business, you know, that's why they talk about churn rate. It's like the number of people who are just like being like, fuck you. Yeah, I'm pissing off out of this game.
Yeah. But this is the good thing that we can do with games is like piss off players as quickly as possible so they stop playing them.
Yes, that's what I'm hearing. So that's the counterintuitive thing, right? Because you have to remember, part of the value of games is that you don't just play one game. That's the thing that Frank was talking about in his talk, that because we're moving between systems and we're understanding the limitations of them and we're understanding that they are not actually, they're not complete. They are simply maps. They're not the territory. They're bounded and have holes in them. They have gaps in what they're representing or simulating. They're not the be-all and end-all. They don't actually represent like a real way of measuring value from performance. There's a lot of arbitrary stuff in them. The more we're reminded that it's kind of bullshit, the better it is for us as human beings, because that's true of systems in the real world too, right? That's the thing about meta-rationality is that you're trying to learn as you sort of try to get beyond just operating purely on logic or just following rules in a process, just operating on an algorithm, that you're like, oh, actually, I need to be able to like discard that one and come up with a different one. I need to be able to like think about not just follow the process, but question what the reason why the process exists is. I need to sort of like pull back the curtain and see all of the underpinnings and weaknesses and gaps and flaws. And that's part of why, like, you know, the more immersive and totalizing and realistic and like, you know, not showing any of its seams, the sort of polished aesthetic, the idea that like, oh, it's much better to not be able to like hit the edge of the world and then hit an invisible wall. Like it's much better if that's disguised, right? That thinking is all like a little bit wrong because, the new point is, and this is all like pretty new, it's like just a bunch of thoughts that me and Frank and other people have had in recent months, is that actually it's kind of good if you like reach the edge of the map and you fall off into an infinite void, or like you figure out how this game is totally glitchy, or like what's completely missing in this game, and you're like, what the hell, this prison game doesn't actually simulate race. That's like, boom, like you blew my mind. I noticed that. It didn't disguise the fact that it's actually not a good prison simulation, right? So the more that, the game acknowledges itself to be imperfect or that you can break it or that it's not complete, the easier it is for us to understand what systems really are. And so when I say, oh, it's great that people get addicted and then disgusted, it's not, of course, good that they got addicted. It's a bad experience. And if they lost money, it's even worse, right?
And it's bad that they got disgusted.
No, it's good
too.
That they got disgusted, right? Because they should be disgusted.
Well, it's indirectly good. We don't want to be disgusting people, right? Like, it's a bad feeling to be disgusted. So, like, I know what you're saying. It's indirectly good because
right.
Then
there's some games where the goal
thing.
Is to be disgusted, right? Like, Brenda Brathwaite wants people to be disgusted when they play Train.
But by and large,
right, because
that's
they're
not
trying
the
to make money off of people usually, but they're.
Well, no, because they're also trying to entertain.
But look
people,
at Factorio.
Right?
Factorio is like a hugely complex strategic simulation game. And it's there's no question in my mind that the developers of that game want you to feel kind of disgusted at some point. It's like the more designed version of the Mognoscanti project from SimCity 3000, which was like carrying the logic of SimCity to its ultimate extreme of like the most dehumanizing, perfectly functioning city that you could build. Factorio is kind of like putting that front and center as the main objective of the game. And people build, the, like turn this untouched planet into like a gigantic smoke spewing factory. And they're simultaneously being like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm making the most complicated process ever. And I'm like doing everything. I'm like pillaging this entire planet for its natural resources. And they're like also simultaneously double consciousness aware. Like, oh, this is like the worst thing ever. I'm totally the villain in this, right?
Sure.
And that's good that they're sort of like, what am I doing, right? The fact that the game acknowledges, not with a big flashy sign, but in its systems itself, it sort of, and the way it represents stuff, it sort of acknowledges like, this is the gross side of economic systems carried to their extreme of efficiency and growth, right? It's like cancerous. That's a good form of disgusting. Of course, in Candy Crush or whatever, they're not doing it deliberately. They're not trying to disgust people, but it's definitely a facet of that sector of the industry overall, that people are getting addicted, then getting disgusted and quitting. And I don't think that that's going good places overall. But I think that if there's something that's positive that comes out of it, it's sort of like exposing children to advertising, right? Like if you want a child to be able to operate in an advertising saturated world, you don't want to insulate them from ever seeing an ad so that they're like Brendan Fraser in that movie where he comes out of the bunker.
I was thinking of the Tarzan.
Yeah, no.
I thought he was... there's
another one because he's always playing these like ingenues who are unfamiliar with the modern world. But there's one where he like has been in a bunker, like being raised as if he's as if it's the 50s. In that movie, you know, he comes into the modern world. He's like totally unprepared. So you can imagine like if you completely protect a kid from modern media, they're not going to know how to absorb it. Right. And maybe there's some kind of equivalent here going on. I think the jury is still out for me on like whether there's anything good about that. But being able to see like, oh, this system is trying to ensnare me. And I did get ensnared a little bit. I understand what that's like. And now I recognize what that feels like. And I am getting better at like breaking out of it. I watch like these like forum conversations from people who are playing like real, like addictive, exploitative free-to-play games with great interest, because the conversation has changed a little bit over the years, and the people who are playing these games are like, okay, like I recognize this pattern in the behavior of the company. I like recognize what it's doing to me. I've like set certain boundaries. My boundaries are being pushed. I really want to do this. Like maybe I'm going to give in. They're like struggling with themselves. And I don't know if I could say that's a great thing. That's sort of like, well, do you want someone to become a gambling addict so they can not become a gambling addict? But in some ways, I think this is a little bit less pernicious than gambling, because it's not as good at extracting money from people unless they're like total spendthrifts or they have like huge amounts of money to spare. It's bad for the whales, for sure. It's bad for the small percentage of people who are like literally bankrupting themselves to buy a hat or something like that.
Sure.
And there are people who have gotten habits. And so it's for sure that there are people who it's like really hurting their whole lives. And you see people talking about their habit of dropping hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars a month on these things. And you're like, okay, that's definitely bad. But that's like at most 1 out of 20 players for the usual statistics, which is terrible. It's a terrible rate to have be harming people. But then there's 19 out of 20 players who are like, I'm resisting this. I'm like, you know, I'm not really falling for it. I'm skimming across the top and sort of seeing what's going on here. And I'm kind of convinced that those people are learning something and they're like noticing what to avoid, which is only good if you accept that like, okay, this kind of system is here to stay, and it's probably not going to stay inside of games. It's going to be used outside of games in some way too, right? And yeah.
Right. Yeah, so, okay, so there's, I pretty much agree with everything you're saying. It's just that I feel like there's another thing, and maybe it's a figment of my imagination, but let me first say that, like, I do agree. One thing that I agree with a lot, and I'm not actually totally sure that I understand. I've never had the phrase meta rationality. This might be the first time I've even heard of that phrase. But let me guess what it is, just from the context of the conversation. I think that you're saying that, like, you know, we have, and it's sort of a response to, if I'm not mistaken, like these rationalists and stuff, and they're, and how thought can be, like, overly rational in and forgetting that the questions that we choose to ask are also a result of, you know, like, who we are and the place where we happen to be looking. And so meta-rationality would be, like, sort of reminding us to take a broader look at, even, like, you know, kind of remind us of the shortcomings of our rationality and our methods of reasoning.
Yeah, I think that's extremely close, and it shows, like, you know, you're quite a good meta-rational thinker. Which I think in some ways you have to be to design multiple games, I guess, because you sort of have to be looking at systems and seeing them as somewhat arbitrary, right, if you're going to, like, be designing them. So I can break down where it comes from. So I was using meta-rationality as the term because that's what Frank uses in his talk to discuss this. And he gets it from this website, Meaningness. So meaningness.com is the site that's about trying to move from rationality to meta-rationality. It's written by this guy with, like, a whole series of essays, and there's a community there you know, there were, like, these kind of very rational or, like, Bayesian rationality websites, like Less Wrong or Reason to Earn or whatever. This is sort of like a next stage outgrowth of those sites. I think he was actually maybe involved in one of them. And the idea is, like, oh, okay, well, you want people to learn to be rational. That's important. But there's actually some other steps beyond just learning to be a logical thinker that we should be aspiring towards. And the author from Meaningness, he calls it meta-rationality. He's referring to this model that was developed in the 60s. And this is how I learned it, like, way back in the day, the Kohlberg stages of moral development. And those are...
Yep, I know about
those. Yeah, so, and they've been used by a bunch of people. Like, they were sort of originally proposed by this guy, Lawrence Kohlberg, and then kind of further adapted by Robert Keegan, who, instead of calling it moral development, which I think had some sort of problematic aspects to it, he sort of talked about it as a type of psychological development, sort of like understanding what your relationship is to other human beings, to society, to your own thoughts. So the idea is that, like, okay, you learn different ways of understanding the world and all of those things that I just mentioned. You start off just being, like, only concerned about yourself and your own sensations and, like, pleasure and pain. And then you get to the second stage where you see, like, oh, there are other human beings in the world. And this is, like, when you're a baby, right? Oh, there are other people. They also have goals and things that they like or dislike. And I have to, like, conform to what they want in order to get what I want. And then you're probably doing that with your parents or your siblings. And then when you get to the third stage, it's much more about, like, social relationships, and you learn to distinguish good intentions from bad intentions, or you think you do, because I think that's pretty difficult for human beings. And then that's where you sort of understand yourself as a part of a social group, and that there are norms that you can kind of identify with and say, like, all right, you know, I'm part of this group, and so I'm going to act like them, and maybe that other group is bad, and what I really want is to, like, you know, stay friends with my friends. And so if that sounds a little bit like an adolescent stage of development, that's kind of how Kohlberg thought of it. And then the fourth stage is the very rational systems-oriented stage. And I think this is part of why it caught Frank's attention recently, that At the fourth stage is Kolberg thought of it as like the law and order stage. You understand, like, actually there are processes and rules, and that you need to follow them, and that it's important that we all agree to follow this a set of rules, and because that's what sort of maintains order and makes society work. And so that's kind of the stage of, yeah, like say like a law and order political candidate who's really focusing on like, you know, we need to make sure that like everything can be safe and that laws are followed and that law-abiding citizens are not threatened by these people who like don't agree right. with our same values, right? And then so then the fifth stage is the meta-rationality stage. And that's characterized by understanding like, oh, okay, it's like having a law to follow is not the be-all and end-all. Actually, we need to sort of understand what underlies those laws, right? That and Kolberg associated this with the idea of the social contract, that like, oh, that's the social contract is not a set of rules that you follow. It's like an idea, principle that we are together making the rules and agreeing on the values and principles that inform all the rules that we're making, and that actually it's possible for us to like renegotiate that kind of contract, maybe, right? Or for it to evolve over time, for there to be some sort of progress,
right.
for us to say like, well, we don't have to continue doing it the traditional way just because that's always been what's done. We should potentially question this, right? And it's a little bit sure. more fluid. It's
and the laws and systems and all those sort of machinations that we have in place also were the result of human bias and a certain kind of person being likely in charge. And and I think that's maybe also part of that conversation about just like sort of realizing that, you know, that I guess re-realizing, because I think that the scary, tempting thing about like logic and rationality and reason and all those things is that they sort of like they offer to take the human error, the human experience error generation or whatever, you know, out of the equation, and now we're just like following the facts unto, you know what I mean, like we're just doing simple addition, and
yeah,
and so maybe meta rationality is also like reminding you like, no, you know, these things are still being wielded by human beings in a particular place in a particular time, and they have right. biases it's, of those human beings
it's sort
of
very contextual into the systems itself, and it's very yeah it's fluid, because you might be sort of saying like, okay, like this does not always apply. There are situations in which it doesn't. And that it kind of resembles some of the more, I don't know, even some of the more ancient lawmaking traditions, like say the Talmud or the Halakha, like, you know, the body of Jewish law is actually very interestingly fluid or flexible. Like, you know, the rabbis will say things like, oh yeah, well, of course it's important to observe the Sabbath, except if like someone is dying, you know, like, right. They're like, of course you should be thinking about right. exceptions to these things instead of just following the rules. And yeah. And so that's what you need to be able to do in order to relate systems to each other, or to sort of understand like what's going on with the system, to be able to step outside of it. So I think we can talk about all sorts of ways. Like if people get overly just focused on a system or logical, they're like, but that's against the rules. You can't do that, right? Rules lawyering would be a kind of like
right.
classic board gamey side of things. Or exploits in online games, I think it's a really interesting one, because there's this point of view that just says, look, the code is the law of the game, and if the code permits me to do this, then it must be okay,
yeah, sure.
and it's the developer's fault if they don't do it.
Right.
And then the developer responds and says, look, it's not just about like whether we specifically said you can't do this or we made it impossible in the code. Also, you need to be abiding by the spirit of like what's going on here in the game. Like we don't, you're going to like break the economy of the game. You're going to ruin it for other people, all of this kind of stuff. So they're like, look, we're banning you. And then people are mad, like, well, you didn't say that I was going to be banned for that, right? And that's come up a lot recently
right.
on social media and in online communities where, you know, if you're a moderator for an online community or a subreddit or something, like, you know some about this, right? It's like, there's often a code of conduct or like a list of things that you are supposed to abide by. And in the smarter communities, there's always like, if there's a list of rules, one of the rules is, look, you know, you also have to abide by what the moderator says. Like, they're the final arbiter of what these rules mean, right? And like what the spirit of the law is. And yeah, exactly. They're the human agency that's like, look, I'm going to interpret this, right? I'm going to be the rabbi who's like, no, that doesn't apply here. You need that kind of, you can't just have the system, just the process or the algorithm. And then there's a certain type of person who's like, that's total BS. You're just making it be whatever you want. It's totally arbitrary. This is all bullshit. Right. And so the accusation from that point is that they don't understand that this meta-rationality is important to be able to judge and understand when rules do or don't apply. They believe that it's actually a reversion to the earlier stage, right, where you're in this cliquish level 3 thing, and they're like, you're just playing favorites. Right. So there's this like conflict going on there. And the thing that Frank and a number of other people are worried about is that they're, and this is true on meaningness.org too, is that if you get stuck at 4 or you're trying to move beyond 4, that there's this like abyss between 4 and 5 where you're like, oh, what this like rules, this rules are bullshit, man. Like, somebody just made these rules up. And then, like, I can't believe it. It's like, doesn't apply in every circumstance at all. There's some judge saying, actually, not this time. This is all garbage. And then that's like the pathway into nihilism, where you're like, nothing means anything, man. It's all just made up. These people are all just
right.
corrupt.
Which is what that is also their, if I'm not mistaken, that is like kind of a bit of a rallying cry for them, is like, you know, yelling about postmodernism and like, So anyway, I'm completely on board with that. And I actually think I haven't thought of sort of disposable games, which has been something that I would say I generally fight against. I want games to be less disposable because I think that games are like, It's not because I want games to be infinitely not disposable, but because I want them to be a little less disposable than they are now. And because I think that actually games are super disposable now, but for their like addictive qualities. And I think you would agree that there is something in systems design there is something about a system that can be compelling and interesting and worth exploring, but that isn't addictive in the same way that we would say, like, you know, booster packs or Candy Crush, whatever.
Or Civilization.
That's what I mean. Like, you brought up Civilization as an example of, like, you know, one of these strategy games. And, you know, to me, I actually think Civilization is very... you know, first of all, the matches are very long. They're like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours long. And then, so their off-ramps are kind of like at a weird place. And then, two, I do think that they are really like windfall-y. And like, when I play Civ, I'm not thinking about, I mean, I'm a little bit thinking about strategy stuff, but I think the compelling thing is like, I really hope everything just falls into place this game, you know, like, and roguelikes are the same way. And so that's the sort of stuff that I want to move away from. Right.
They just give you a lot to think about in a looping pattern, and you sort of fall into the patterns endlessly. Right?
Exactly. And so the most compelling thing about them is not their like rule sets in the way that I'm pursuing, but it is, it is that, like, you know, oh, I'm going to find like turn 6, I'm going to find like one of those little villages, and it's going to give me a huge tech for free this time. And I'm going to like get this crazy leg up on everybody. And then, you know what I mean? Like, and I think that is, that we're like waiting for these windfalls a lot of the time. And that's something I fight against a lot. So my like, I think we got to like wrap up ish soon, but my main thing that I feel like your point of view, and this is something I feel like about most people who talk about games, it seems to me that it's very pessimistic, because it sounds like you think that games will never be really, I mean, like, it sounds like sometimes that your position is that the best games can do is teach you not to play games quickly. And like, I
no, I mean, I wouldn't put it that way at all. Okay. Because to me, that's not pessimistic, right? Like, I love games like a microbiologist loves bacteria, right? It's like,
not animals.
You might think of bacteria. Yeah, I mean, they don't know, a bacteria doesn't have to be an elephant to be beautiful to a microbiologist.
Yeah, no, that's true.
You know, and that's why I'm often advocating for, like, little strange games that are evolving quickly. And, like, in their own little strange petri dishes, mm-hmm. right? Because I see this ambition in you and in other people in various ways, like in, say, like the No Man's Sky developers, right, who also wanted to make a game that you could just live in forever, but they have very different design values than you do, right?
Yeah.
Where I'm like, what? Like, why is that good? Like, what? Why is that? That doesn't seem that great to me. Not because I'm pessimistic about like how grand a game is, but because like or how grand games could be, but because I don't see all that much value in grandness. It's like, you know, it's trying to make the perfect food that I could just like eat every day for the rest of my life. That does appeal to some people, and especially people who buy Soylent. But for me, I would rather like eat a different thing every single day for the rest of my life and experience like all the flavors, right? So. And for games, for me particularly, that's important because I think of it as an exploration of possibility space, because I think there's all sorts of things like we don't understand about what games do to our minds, or like what they're working out in our brains, or like how they're allowing us to self-reflect. And it just makes me want to support more and more and more experiments that are less derivative and doing more new things. Or in some cases, they don't have to not be derivative. They might be actually exploring new territory by going very, very deep into something, right? So that's why I always admire your emphasis on depth and being like, let's like really get to the bottom of this particular path. But for me, it's like, okay, that's one path. I'm interested in seeing like where Keith goes with that. And I will always play your games. But I don't know if I will ever play any of your games in the way that you're hoping that I will, right? Where I'm like, I'm just going to spend tons and tons of time with this. Because I would have to make a sacrifice for that. It's a, you know, time that you have alive and things you spend attention on are a zero-sum game. And because of this meta-rationality, because I want to have a variety of experiences, because I'm curious about like what games can do or what they can't do or what all the failures that we could experience are on our way to like figuring that out. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just much more important to me that I get to see like a lot of different attempts that we sort of like send shoots out into explore the reaches of space, like in every direction, instead of just being like, well, what is the best star to send our expedition to? You know, I think our calculations show that we've got to go to Proxima Centauri.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Send everyone there.
Let me reframe that in a slightly different way. That's an acceptable framing. But another way that you can frame that disagreement is like, because if I'm getting you correctly, what you want out of games is already happening. It's already here, right? Like, you just kind of, you want us to keep doing what we're doing, more or less, right? I mean,
kind of. I mean, I think it's, you know, I think it's got huge problems, right?
Sure.
Like, we have seen, there's been a Cambrian explosion in the last 8 years.
Yeah.
I'm certainly concerned that it's not sustainable, that a lot of people are, like, trying to do interesting experiments, and they're kind of, like, attempting something and it's fizzling out, or they can only do it at the very smallest scale, and some ideas actually need a little bit more more investment or time or support in order to grow, right? And and that like funding models are collapsing left and right, and there's still like most of the attention and energy and funding goes towards these very, very large productions that have to be relatively low risk because there's so much money invested in them, and mm-hmm. they still stick to pretty safe territory. I mean, I think I am in part reacting to like what I've seen as being very positive about indie games and alt games, and that I would like to see continue. But yeah, I think I'm trying to articulate like what the value is in that and why I think like we should keep going and not just fall into like, oh, now there's indie games and they fall into these very established categories. We're making roguelikes and we're making survival games and we're making battle royales,
right?
You know, and
well, I hope you don't think I disagree with you on that at all. I mean,
I know you don't, but I'm just responding to your, it's like, yeah, I think we are doing this, but it's not necessarily going to keep happening. And we sort of have to articulate like why we think it's good.
Sure.
If we would like this to continue going on or like make efforts to try and figure out how to sustain it.
Right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I'm glad that I want to, for those who are interested in the project of strategic depth, I want us as a species to be able to do that better. And but that is, I agree, that is just one thing. And I have so many notes, that things that I wanted to talk about that we didn't really get to. Maybe we can do another one another time, but I think that's really interesting and fascinating. I think I have very mixed feelings about the off-ramp thing. I mean, for what it's worth, my games are always going to have very, very clear off-ramps, which is just an end of a match. I don't know. Do you think that counts, by the way, as an off-ramp?
Yeah, I definitely think it does. I mean, certainly once you get over a certain length, it does, right? There are some games, like I think, you know, Terry Kavanaugh was very good at pioneering this, where the round lengths are so short, they're like under 30 seconds, that you're like, I'm going to jump back in again right away.
Yeah.
Right. But if they're a little bit longer, a little bit more exhausting, you can be like, oh, phew, okay, I'm done. I'm going to stop playing for a little bit. And if that is self-contained, then there's no like timer system where it's like, oh, you can collect the resources from having won this match. If you come back and play another match in 4 hours, you know, then
right.
Then I think that qualifies pretty well as an off-ramp.
Cool. Well, all right. Well, I think maybe we could wrap up there. I think everyone should go check out they can buy Consenticle right now still, right?
Yeah. So this I maybe should have mentioned at the top of the show. It's actually, you cannot buy it anymore.
Oh, no.
When I said that there are 7,000 copies, like almost all of those are spoken for. They've been purchased already. And we had to like decide on this exact size of the print run, and people kept on wanting to buy the extra ones. So there are very, very few unspoken for copies. I don't even know how many there will be, because there's always some like damage in shipping and copies that have to be replaced and so forth. So I'm not going to know for like another month or two, like how many we can actually still sell, or exactly how we're going to sell those. So it's much more difficult than it was a few months ago when I was still taking orders to actually get a copy of Consenticle. There are some stores that will be selling it, and I'm going to try and like, you know, put together a list of those, and, you know, get it on my website and Twitter, which are what you usually get if you search for Consenticle. But
what about a print and play version? Have you considered that?
Yeah, so there is a print and play version. I've released the first beta of that to the Kickstarter backers, and I'm taking feedback on it. I'm going to do a revision and put out another print and play version, which you'll be able to buy. But as far as getting a physical copy, I don't anticipate there being a second run, and I priced it in such a way where it was cheap enough that it doesn't fund the second run. That's something a lot of people don't know, is that like in board games, usually the price is set so that you're paying not just for the print run that produced the game, but also for the next print run.
Ah, interesting.
So to do that, I would have had to charge like another $10. For the game.
Gotcha.
And I was like, no, I want this game to be cheap. I don't want to like continue selling it forever and have to be like, you know, doing this like with 2 days out of the week for the rest of my life or whatever, or
right.
Until it's no longer popular. So I'm like, I'm just doing one run. So I am not conforming to the usual like consumer global supply chain logic that way. But I'm hoping that, yeah, there will be some stores where people can buy it. I'll try to sell the extra copies in as feasible a way as I can until those run out. But people are going to have, this is actually the window where you can't get one.
And that concludes my interview with Naomi Clark. If you enjoyed this, please consider supporting me on Patreon, like I mentioned at the top of the show. I'm going to have new show episodes. I'm going to have new articles. I'm going to have new videos. I haven't done a video in a while, but I'm going to do one soon. This summer is going to be really good. We're going to do Twitch streams. We're going to do the book club. We're going to do all kinds of stuff. You can also give me ideas for things that you might like to see from me in terms of games, prototypes. I'm also really big on supporting other small indies who are trying to do similar stuff. We've got a bunch of community games over on my forums, and I'm trying to support them and give them a place to get feedback that makes sense to them in the language that we speak over at keithburgon.net. Anyways, thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show, and I will see you again next time.